Well, thank you, Stephen, for an extremely generous introduction. Can I too acknowledge the meeting on the lands of the Gadigal people and pay my respects to elders past and present, to acknowledge the per capita family, Emma Dawson, Alison Orr, Helen Conway, David Hetherington, Jeff Gallup, and many friends and colleagues in the room. It would be remiss of me not to acknowledge that my parents are here today. It's always good fun getting to give a speech for your parents in the room. And of course, to acknowledge Stephen Price and the support of CAWS for allowing us to enjoy your hospitality, your refreshments, and, of course, this beautiful view. No better place to watch Sydney showers than from the perspective of a high-rise building like this one. I'd also acknowledge that per capita has recently made inequality its core purpose. And I really commend per capita for doing this. I think it is a marker of the importance of this issue. And it's a real pleasure to be speaking about inequality in this important reform agenda series, a series that I've always admired since then Prime Minister Julia Gillard launched it 6 years ago. There's many forms of inequality, but perhaps the starkest is the difference between those who own no assets and earn their living by selling their labour, and those who earn vast assets and can live off the proceeds. Between those two extremes lies home ownership. It's not a perfect marker, but if you don't own a home, it's likely you live by the sweat of your brow. Conversely, if you're living off your investments, it's a pretty good bet that you own your home. At the end of World War II, Australia was a nation where just 53% of households owned their homes. In the major cities, the figure was just 46%. Most city dwellers rented. Most homes were made of wood or fibro cement. Then in the post-war years, something remarkable happened. The Australian home ownership rate soared. By 1954, it was up to 63%. By 1961, it was up to 70%. In just over a decade, the distribution of Australia's housing wealth became markedly more equal. And it wasn't just homes. Shared prosperity in the post-war decades meant cars became cheaper. By the 1960s, most Australian homes had a vacuum cleaner, a washing machine, a television and a fridge. Items that before the war had only been owned by the most affluent. Even access to university was shared out more evenly. For someone like my grandfather, Keith Lee, attending Melbourne University would have been impossible on a modest clergyman's wage. Only a post-war veteran scholarship made it possible. The intellectual seeds for those changes were sown in John Curtin's white paper on full employment and his clearly professed view that there will have to be a fairer distribution of wealth. The surprising thing is what happens next. Under Robert Menzies, the coalition didn't choose to mount a stirring defence of property investors. They didn't choose to rail against attempts to increase home ownership as socialism by stealth. Instead, they presided over a steady rebalancing of the economy and even went so far as to incorporate home ownership into their story of what the new built Liberal Party stood for. With the home ownership rate now the lowest it's been in six decades, it's worth remembering the Liberal Party hasn't always been the party of landlords. When it came to wages, Menzies presided over average wage growth five times faster than it had been in the first four decades after Federation. With today's Conservatives fearful of a wages breakout, it's worth remembering Australia once had a Liberal Party that valued strong wage growth. Equality is a Labor value, but it isn't just a Labor value. It's also an Australian one. Robert Menzies knew this. But I sometimes wonder if his intellectual ears do. This is the second of three talks on inequality in a series I'm calling Just Ideas. In the first talk, I focused on the question of why we should care about inequality. Today, I'll be looking at the drivers of inequality. In the final talk, we'll look at what we might do to reduce inequality. So let's start with the role of union membership. At the time of Australian Federation in 1901, union membership was fairly rare, with about 1 in 10 workers in a union. But over the next dozen and a bit years, the share of union members quadrupled, reaching 4 out of 10 by the outbreak of World War I, 1914. Not coincidentally, this was also the period the most rapid growth for the political party representing organised labour, the Australian Labour Party. For Labour the party and Labour the movement, the early years of the 20th century were heady days indeed. From 1920 to 1980, the union membership rate in Australia averaged 49%. That's where it was in 1982. Then it began to plunge. It was down to 40% in 1992, 30% in 1997, 20% in 2006. According to the latest figures from the Australian Bureau of Statistics, 15% of Australian workers are now in a union. In the United States, the figure is 11%. Now, at this point, it's worth noting that the Australian Bureau of Statistics figures are for 2014. More recent data from the Australian Council of Trade Unions suggests a higher membership rate. But with that caveat in mind, let's stick with the Bureau of Statistics figures, since they allow us to look at different subgroups. Their headline figure suggests that union membership now is back where it was in 1906, 110 years ago. Among private sector workers, the official union membership estimate is 11%. For those born overseas, it's 12%. For workers aged under 25, just 7% are in a union. Among the industries where union membership has now fallen below a tenth are accommodation, agriculture, defence, printing, and the performing arts. If the current rate of decline continues, the overall union membership rate will reach 10% in 2022. Over the years, unions have brought lasting gains in the workplace. Sick leave in the 1920s, annual leave in the 1930s, the 8-hour day in the 1940s, unfair dismissal protections in the 1970s, banning asbestos in the 1980s, the weekend. Careful economic research finds unions have a causal impact on making workplaces safer. And today, unions are making the case for domestic and family violence leave. Unions, too, have often found themselves on the right side of history. Maritime unions refused to load pig iron onto Japanese ships in the late 1930s because they foresaw the risk that it would come back in bombs. When 200 Gurindji people walked off the Wave Hill cattle station in 1966, it was the trade union movement that supported the right of Indigenous people to be fairly paid. If you've ever enjoyed Centennial Park and the Sydney Botanic Gardens, you should thank the union members who stopped them being bulldozed in the 1970s. Unsurprisingly, unions also increase wages. One recent study finds that unions increase wages by 5 to 10%, which isn't a bad return, considering that the average union membership due is less than 1% of salary. But for the purposes of thinking about inequality, it's important to note that the impact of unions is strongest on the bottom of the distribution. Unions often campaign for dollar pay increases rather than percentage pay increases, for pay equity across workplaces, and for pay equity between industries. The 2012 social and community sector workers' case is a good example of this. In that case, the five unions noted that around 80% of workers in the social and community sectors were women. They argued that because they did caring work, they'd been systematically underpaid, compared with those in other occupations who had comparable skills and worked in similar conditions. Fair Work Australia agreed and laid down an 8-year transition to better pay for those workers. But as union membership declines, it'll be steadily more and more difficult for these kinds of cases to be brought. One analysis by Jeff Borland estimates that in the 1980s and 1990s, declining inequality was responsible for up to a third of the increase in Australian, describing unionisation was responsible to up to a third of the increase in Australian wage inequality. And that parallels what's been found in Britain and in the United States. To illustrate the point, let's take the gender pay gap. Using the Melbourne Institute's Household Income and Labour Dynamics in Australia survey, or HILDA, I calculated the gender pay gap in hourly earnings across about 8,000 workers. Among non-union workers, women earn 13% less than men. But among unionised workers, women earned 7% less than men. Unions approximately halved the gender pay gap. The same is true for Indigenous workers. If they're not in a union, Indigenous people earn 18% lower hourly wages than non-Indigenous workers. But if you compare those who are in a union, the racial pay gap falls to 5%. In other words, two-thirds of the racial pay gap is gone among unionised workers. In both cases, gender and race, unions don't close the pay gaps entirely, but they make a huge difference. So every time you see someone proposing policies that make it harder for unions to organise, remember what this means for our economy. A larger gender pay gap, Indigenous Australians being left further behind, and more economic inequality. Another big driver of inequality is the twin forces of technology and globalisation. They're best discussed together because they interact. For example, most technologies Australia uses weren't invented here. But they're also worth discussing together because they impact our economy in a similar kind of way. Let me take a simple example. Suppose we created a magical machine that turned iron ore into televisions. You dump a shipload of iron ore into the machine and it magically churns out 2,000 televisions. We might call that magical machine trade. You can also think of the change in terms of trade as being a bit like a big technological improvement. By the peak of the boom, the way that trade machine worked is when you dumped in a shipload of iron ore, it spat out not 2,000 but 20,000 televisions. And in general, both globalisation and technology tend to increase the wages of those further up the distribution. Machines are particularly good at taking the jobs of routine workers, which is why we've seen a huge decline in Australian occupations such as typists and bookkeepers. If you line up Australian occupations in order of hourly wages and graph the change in the number of positions, then you get a U-shape over the last few decades. In Australia, as in many other advanced nations, the labour market's increasingly become polarised. And as those middle-paid occupations disappear, the people who did them have cascaded down into lower-paid occupations. There's more demand for jobs like security guards and baristas. But because those occupations don't require a great deal of training, the increase in demand for their services hasn't translated into a big increase in wages. In the case of globalisation, we know that open markets have brought significant benefits to Australia. For example, an analysis by the Centre for International Economics found that trade liberalisation over recent decades benefited the Australian household by around $4,000 annually. But it's important to also remember the distributional impacts of trade. Since the work of Wolfgang Stolper and Paul Samuelson, economists have recognised that while trade raises aggregate living standards, appreciate the thunder to emphasise the point, the benefits aren't evenly shared across the community. From Peter Cook to Craig Emerson, Penny Wong to Jason Clare, Labor's trade representatives have consistently held the view that market liberalisation must be accompanied by a strong safety net. Free trade and social democracy go together. Recent United States studies have reinforced the importance of this approach. In the 1990s, America imported twice as much from developed as from developing nations. Among economists, the consensus back then was that trade had only a small impact on inequality. But now in the United States, developing country imports are higher than developed country imports. And work by David Auder and co-authors suggests that trade might in fact have a larger impact on inequality. I haven't seen a similar analysis for Australia, but it's worth noting the change of the composition of our imports. In 1990, the average wage in our top five import supplying nations was 95% of the average Australian wage. Today, the average wage in our top five import supplying nations is 56% of the Australian average. Now, this isn't an argument against open markets. It's a reminder of the importance of active labour market programs and a strong social safety net. Another big driver of inequality is the tax system. Analysing top income shares in five English-speaking countries, Tony Atkinson and I estimated that about a third of the increase in top income inequality in the past generation was driven by reductions in top marginal tax rates. Indeed, over the course of the last 100 years, it's astonishing how closely top income shares track the after-tax share of the top. In other words, 100% minus the top marginal tax rate. Now, there's good reasons why Australia reduced the top marginal tax rate from 60% in the early 1980s to 47% in the 1990s and 45% in recent years. But it's important to recognise that the benefits of further rate reductions at the top go overwhelmingly to the most affluent. For example, on the 1st of July next year, the Coalition's 2% temporary budget repair levy will cease. And that'll effectively provide a 2% income tax cut to that top tax bracket, which starts at $180,000. By my calculations, 94% of the benefits of that tax cut will go to the top 1% of adults, a group that's doubled its income share in the last generation. I'm just not sure that group needs another tax cut. And then there's the question of the breadth of the tax base. During the Hawke-Keating years, Australia saw the introduction of capital gains taxation and fringe benefits taxation, closing off significant tax loopholes used disproportionately by those at the top. By contrast, the Howard years saw a halving of the capital gains tax rate for long-held assets and the creation of new superannuation tax breaks to the significant benefit of those at the top. Similar debate arises when we look at the transfer system. When it comes to reducing inequality, the Australian social safety net has traditionally been the best targeted in the world. According to UNSW's Peter Whiteford, the average advanced country gives twice as much welfare to the bottom fifth of the population as to the top fifth. But Australia gives 12 times as much to the poor as to the rich. As with tax, there's nothing automatic about this outcome. Under the Howard government, the redistributive effect of government payments declined by a quarter. Labor took the opposite approach when we were in government by increasing the use of means testing to ensure that those who received transfer payments were those who really needed them the most. Anytime we tweak the tax transfer system, it's worth remembering we're dealing with the most efficient inequality-reducing welfare system in the world. Bolt on a regressive paid parental leave, as was proposed by the Abbott government, and you make it less efficient. Increase waiting periods for young people to access unemployment benefits, and you increase inequality. Change pension indexation so it's linked to prices rather than wages, and you increase inequality. Or, as I mentioned in my last talk, increase the pension, as happened in 2009, and you can move 1 million people out of poverty. The final driver of inequality I want to talk about today is market concentration. And I want to be the first to admit that my views on this have changed markedly since 2013 when I wrote Battlers and Billionaires. Back then, I barely touched on market structure as a factor driving inequality. And if you'd asked me my view on market concentration at that stage, I probably would have said, I didn't think market concentration was a very serious problem. and that the Hilmer reforms in the early 1990s had done most of the necessary work. My view started to shift when I read a terrific book by my friend and co-author Tony Atkinson, titled Inequality, What Can Be Done, which argues that excessive concentration is a key driver of inequality. At around the same time, The Economist magazine published an analysis of competition in the United States, which showed that across 893 industries, markets were heavily concentrated, and that since the early 1990s, two-thirds of US industries had become more concentrated. This prompted Australian National University researcher Adam Triggs and I to conduct a similar study for Australia, published this month in the Australian Economic Review. Unlike the United States, where a government agency collects data on market share, our Australian analysis relied on figures collected by IBIS World, a private firm that carries out research on a variety of industries. To be precise, we went through 481 IBIS World reports and crunched the figures to calculate the industry share of the big four firms. Now, a common rule of thumb in industrial organisation is that a market's concentrated when the big four have more than 30% market share. On that benchmark, most Australian industries are concentrated markets, with the average market share of the big four coming in at 36%. Triggs and I find that Australian markets are more concentrated than in the United States, where the average market share of the big four is 33%, recalling ours is 36%. Just to take a few concrete examples. In the US, the big four liquor retailers have 10% of the market. Here, they've got 78%. Their big four health insurers have 35% of the market. Ours have 93% of the market. Their big four cardboard box manufacturers have 36% of the market. Ours have got 88% of the market. And there's a plethora of Australian markets where the big four have not more than 30%, but more than 80% of the market, ranging from baby food to beer. That's partly due to more mergers. The number of mergers that took place last year was three times as many as in the early 1990s. The value of those merger deals, more than 10 times as high. Another indication that rising concentration is a drop-off in the number of firms in the economy. There are around 20,000 fewer Australian firms now than in 2012. For all the talk about startups, new firms are significantly less likely to get off the ground today than they were just a few years ago. The startups are stopping. Increased market concentration hurts consumers directly through higher prices and less variety. And disadvantaged consumers can bear the brunt of this. The poorer you are, the more likely it is that you spend your entire paycheck. Low-income consumers are less able to avoid excessive markups by driving to the next suburb or hopping online to get a better deal. And when you think about the production side, some of the excess profits from market concentration in a highly unionised economy would have flowed through to wages. But with union membership at a 110-year low, it's more likely to show up in executive salaries or profits. And, as it happens, CEO pay has massively outpaced average worker salaries in recent decades. And the profit share has also risen. Incidentally, market concentration might also be responsible for the slump in business investment we've seen recently. So, if anyone asks you what this talk was about, here's what you might say. The big drivers of inequality are union membership, technology, globalisation, taxes, transfers, and market concentration. Put another way, the best friends of egalitarianism include a fair transfer system and good unions, while some of the biggest challenges are robots and monopolies. There's one other big driver of inequality I haven't mentioned, and that's education. I've held off talking about it today because I want to focus on it properly in my third and final talk on what can be done about rising inequality. So please, watch this space. But because we're headed into the Christmas season, I wanted to wrap up by saying something timely about one simple tool to reduce inequality. Weekend loadings, commonly known as penalty rates. Now, as every economist knows, weekends and public holidays exist for one simple reason: to solve the leisure coordination problem. Suppose two people want to meet up in a park one morning to kick a football around. In a world without weekends, both would have to coordinate their schedules with their employers. But in a world with weekends, they can simply choose to get together on a Saturday or a Sunday. If we didn't have weekends, there'd be a whole lot less sport, music, and social activities in the world. What weekend loadings do is they discourage employers from rostering people on weekends unless necessary. In some cases, they're passed on to customers, as with cafes and restaurants that pass on a surcharge to customers on weekends and public holidays. But weekend loadings also have an impact on inequality. To see this, I took another look at that Melbourne Institute HILDA survey to see who works on weekends. And it turns out that weekend workers tend to be lower paid than average. Those who work on Saturday and Sunday earn 80% of what those who work only Monday and Friday get. Weekend loadings go to people who tend to earn less. Now, often inequality can be complicated and statistical, but sometimes the role of public policy economists is to cut through the dross and say it like it is. Cut weekend and holiday loadings, and you'll make the nation less equal. If you love Australian egalitarianism, one simple way to defend it is to support lower paid workers getting a bit extra for working when everyone else is on holiday. In advance, best wishes for the holidays. Thanks for listening today. I look forward to your questions.